we get the hour underway by welcoming into the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming, whose newest book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, is available everywhere fine books are sold. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, Kimball. How's it going?
I'm living the dream, my friend. How are you?
I'm not good. I am living, we'll do a turn of phrase, I'm living the nightmare. So we have both sides of the coin covered, Kimball.
Well, we'll meet in the middle and make the world a better place for everybody else. A lot of things to talk about today. And I mentioned earlier that the first one, your hypothesis that Fred Lynn's Red Sox career might be overrated, is a reminder that memory is a powerful tool, because my initial reaction was, oh, Colin, you youngster, you don't remember the Gold Dust Twins. And then I went back and looked at the numbers. You may have a pretty good case, sir.
His numbers kind of go both ways at once, I would say. But I brought this up with you because a lot of people, and I think our buddy Bruce Pratt is not amongst them. I don't think he's a Bruce or Fred Lynn fan, really, to be honest with you. But
because he's a Yankee guy.
Yeah, I know. I learned that recently about about Bruce. And to Bruce's credit, shows how much respect I have for him. I did not respect him less than I thought about. I thought, no, he's good. He's Pratt. But when people talk about Fred Lynn, they do, as you said, to that kind of like prismatic lens of nostalgia, that he was just this surefire on his way to the Hall of Fame type player. A no-brainer to hear people talk about it now through that, again, lens of memory. And if you go through the numbers, his Red Sox career was, I feel like it was shorter than people tend to remember it as. He was there from, of course, 1975. That's the big season that he has where he's Rookie of the Year, he's MVP, and no one had ever done that before as a rookie. And he leaves after 1980. It seems like everybody, a lot of players at least, left after 1980 around that time, and Fisk was another one. And his best year was not his MVP year.
No.
It was 1979. And I think the reason why, I remember reading this once on social media, I think the reason Bruce doesn't like Fred Lynn is because he nurses his own theory that Lynn was a proto-juicer. Because his home run totals went from 21 to 10 to 18 to 22 to, boom, 39. And people out there might be like, 39 home runs. That's fine, but not amazing. It was amazing at the time. 30 home runs was a big deal. In fact, Reggie Jackson, home run slugger supreme, never hit 30 home runs in consecutive seasons in his entire career. So that gives you an idea what a big deal that number was.
And obviously, Lynn dealt with some injuries, not just in Boston, but throughout his career. But you know, he averaged, in his Red Sox years, 20 homers, 85 runs batted in. Good, but Hall of Fame worthy? Probably not.
He has the two standout years, but it's like his stats are strange. When you look at these years, because he's one of those guys who modern metrics rewards, like he was good for the most part at OPS and OPS Plus. OPS Plus is a big one. OPS Plus essentially measures where you stand versus the average ball player. So it starts at like 100. Anything over 100, you're above average. Below 100, you're below average offensively now. So he has the big year in 75. And then the next year, he becomes this kind of singles hitter, really. Has the 10 home runs, 65 RBI, but he hits 314. His OPS was always fairly flashy, though. It was 835 that year. His OPS plus is 132. Mm. But the next year, it dips to 99. And when you're at 99 for OPS, you're a below average offensive player. Like, people think, for instance, that Bill Buckner was really this offensive contributor to the 1986 Red Sox. But he was actually a below-average major league ball player, an offensive ball player. His OPS was 98, to give you an idea. The high is, of course, Babe Ruth for OPS Plus for their career. Pretty sure Ruth is at 206, which is not obviously particularly human. But you get kind of these pedestrian numbers with Lynn, but you can't really disparage him because he has the 872 OPS. He's always somewhere around there. So he was also a guy who fared well with war. And you have these kind of almost like empty calorie stats, I feel like. I feel like Mookie Betts was a little bit that way at times, although he was a better ball player than Fred Lynn, where it's like, whoa, Mr. 4.1 WAR just by showing up, and that was Lynn.
Also a tremendous defensive player, too, but that also was part of his downfall because he was always crashing into walls.
Who's that guy in the Dodgers, like way back, Pistol Pete Reiser? He was always
crashing. Oh, Pete Reiser, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so Fred Lynn had that going for him, too, at the time, and the Fenway walls back then were not the not like running into anything, no matter how well padded is like comforting, I'm sure, but they were, even if you see these old games on YouTube, the walls look harder. And if you remember like balls going off the Green Monster, it was like this metal sheet,
right,
some plastic wrapped over it, and it would make that ting like kind of noise when Yastrzemski turned around to field the ball. So yeah, he was obviously helped too on the WAR front by his defense, but he was a guy who was sort of like a 19 to 21 home run sort of guy, an 80 RBI kind of guy, and a pretty good average guy, and good at getting on base. Like, he was a very serviceable plus ball player, but nowhere really in his career do you see this trajectory for the Hall of Fame. Like, there's some guys that are not as close as we like to think or tend to think. Then there are other guys that you don't think of as close at all who are closer than you'd believe. Nomar Garciaparra is a good example of that. You look at his career, it's like, oh, .313 career batting average. You can sort of make a case. If he was a better defender, Garciaparra really has a chance that Lynn doesn't on the whole truncated Red Sox career front.
Speaking of guys who I suspect of being juicers back in the day.
Garciaparra, yeah, that cover
right
didn't help him, but I don't know. He had the big surge in home runs too, I remember, but he was lacing line drives right when he came up.
Oh, yeah.
Went for, I think, what was it, like 35 in his second year. But that explosion with Lynn, because Lynn does not have a season like 1979 where he hits the 39 home runs. His career best, and he did it a bunch of times, was, no, one year he had 25, but like that was kind of the beyond what you'd expect from Fred Lynn, because he was a line drive hitter, and he was a singles guy, and he was a doubles guy. Now, I think the case for him for the Hall of Fame, with the whole Red Sox thing, rests with Fenway Park and how well-served he would have been to remain in that ballpark as a left-handed hitter, peppering that wall, the Wade Boggs approach, who we talked about recently. But he was nowhere near that like sort of level of ball player or hitter that Boggs was. He came up, and he caught the imagination that year with Jim Rice, as you mentioned, and that team was sort of beloved as this team that couldn't get over the top of the mountain, and he was sort of, it doesn't hurt. You know this, Kimball. You live with this. It doesn't hurt to be good looking.
Well, no, and I will say he's done something right along the way, because
yeah,
I see pictures of him on Twitter, and he's close to 70, if not there already. The man looks great.
You know who I saw the other night, too, who also looks great, and I hadn't seen him in a long time. He was doing the post-game show, Ellis Burks.
Yes.
Ellis Burks is a fit-looking, handsome man. Like, Ellis Burks looks like he could, okay, I can DH for today. That will,
yeah, and he's got to be, what, 50 or so?
Yeah. You know, the thing that's so strange about Ellis Burks, too, is because, like, you remember him from, like, 87 and 88, that Morgan Magic year. The idea, it's like, it fries your brain that he was technically on the 2004 Red Sox. It's just so strange. Because think about that. 2004 was when a lot of people started to have high-def television, which we just take for granted now. So you didn't even necessarily have, you know how you see like an old broadcast and they show a clip and you see like they do those margins on the TV. Ellis Burks played ball in an era when that didn't happen. So it was right. Like your TV looks like now, which is just strange.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Well, let's go from the Red Sox to the Bruins from 30 years ago, the 1991 Bruins, and particularly the play of one Cam Neely, who had a stellar season at age 25.
Cam Neely was, I've been thinking about him, because players don't score goals the way that Cam Neely scored goals. Now that sounds like he would just charge to the net and rock 'em, sock 'em hockey. That's not what I mean. He would find these patches of ice, like this stealth merchant, and show up at the right time when the play went a certain way and he was open for a pass and he had the Mike Bossy quick release guys don't score like that anymore. Guys score by the one-timer. You'll see that. Guys score with speed off the rush. You don't see many slot scores, though. It's not really a thing anymore that you ever get. Shots, goals tend to come either off of deflections or from further out. And I didn't look up the exact numbers again, but I remember seeing ones that Neely's career hat tricks, he had like a mess of them, as you'd imagine. And I'd mentioned this to you once privately. I believe he only had 3 hat tricks on the road in his entire career.
Wow.
Isn't that such a strange stat? I've never, like, it doesn't, he wasn't being held out of games at this point. Well, we're going to come to that in a second. That he's ultimately missing because of his knee injury. But he just did not score hat tricks. He only got them at the Boston Garden.
He put up some phenomenal numbers in that 1990-91 season. 51 goals and 40 assists.
He had 16 goals in 19 games in the playoffs. And to put that in perspective, the one season record for playoff goals is 19. So he almost got there missing that final round, which, of course, the Bruins didn't make. And Ray Bourque was maybe the best, Mario Lemieux. But after Lemieux, Bourque, and probably still Gretzky, Bourque might have been the third best player in the world at this juncture of his career. He didn't win Norris trophies early on. He had such stiff competition. And even when he won Norris trophies, he also had stiff competition. But he was just like all world at this stage of the game. And they came roaring into that, well, it was the Wales Conference at the time, final. And they were playing a Penguins team that was over 500, but not that far above 500. And defensively, they were a team-wide sieve. They scored tons of goals. They were almost like the early run-and-gun Oilers, but a poor man's version of that Oilers team. And things are going well. The Bruins are favored. They actually have a real chance to win the Cup that particular year, and they probably would have won because it's Minnesota that comes out of the Campbell Conference, and Minnesota was just like dire. Their record for the entire season was well below 500, and they had to get hot to even get up to something like pretty Drecky. And the Bruins didn't really have a chance in the 86-87 finals, and then they played that other Oilers team in 89-90 the year before, minus Gretzky, but still, that was Messier, that was Curry, that was Glenn Anderson, that was Bill Ranford coming back to haunt the Bruins. But this year, it looked like they really could make a go of it, and they get up 2-0 in the series. They go to Pittsburgh, and you have the knee-on-knee hit with Alf Samuelson and Cam Neely. And Cam Neely was never the same physical presence after, but he became a different kind of goal scorer. But that pretty much canceled the Bruins for this series.
Well, and I was looking at the roster, remembering some of the names I've forgotten. Davy Christian had a very good year for him, and a guy that got off to a great start in his career, but injuries took their toll. Glenn Wesley was terrific that season with 43 points for the Bruins.
Glenn Wesley was kind of like that era's Gord Kluzak, who's like still technically around. He played like a couple games that season. But you're getting surprise contributions, too, from Ken Hodge Jr., with 30 goals. And 30 goals was kind of like a big deal. It was a benchmark sort of number. You had Craig Janney, who was setting up Neely like Joey Juneau would after, and Adam Oates, too. And they were solid. They had a lot of guys who were like third-line plus players. You mentioned Christian. They had Dave Poulin, and he was there. And you had seen this transition in goal from Lemelin to Andy Moog. And Andy Moog, at this juncture of his career, could be a bit Civ-like himself in the playoffs. And so what happens after that whole Neely incident is the coach at the time, Mike Milbury, who was himself a fan of old-school Rock'em Sock'em hockey, he puts my man, Nevin Marquardt, in the cookbook. Puts him into the lineup, a bunch of guys like Nevin Marquardt, and says, boys, let's goon it up. And the Bruins were so hell-bent on extracting revenge for what had happened to Neely, who was largely ineffective, that they just ran around trying to kill these Penguins. And the Penguins didn't take the bait, and they were laced with talent. Then Kevin Stevens, people think, like, Kevin Stevens, what does that mean? He was like the rich man's Cam Neely for like a year or two. Didn't last that long. But he was like the sort of du jour power forward of the league back when you had power forwards, which you don't really, people try to use that term now. They don't really exist the same way because it's such a speed and finesse game and you don't like truck people like the power forward would. But there was a lot of talent. This is the year the Penguins have Paul Coffey and just Hall of Famer after Hall of Famer. Tom Barrasso should be in the Hall of Fame. And so after winning those first two games, the Bruins became the hapless bees and did not win again.
Couple of former Maine Black Bears on that team as well, Bobby Beers. And I think he only played in one game, but backup and actually third-string goaltender Matt Del Judas was on that team.
They used, similar to this Bruins team, they used four goalies that year. And it makes me wonder, because these current Bruins have a very interesting goalie situation to me. Obviously, Rask will be the number one guy. But is your man, Swayman, is he going to be the backup for the playoffs?
He is, I believe.
I didn't expect to see Halak come back again. I thought he was done. He gets the COVID, he's out, and it's just like hard luck, Wally Pipp type of thing. And Lou Gehrig reference for people. But they stuck him back in, which was just a weird move to me to make if you were going to have Swayman be the backup and potentially the guy who, if Rask falters, could be the guy. But yes, the Bruins goalies and their goalie situation has been littered with Black Bears over the years.
Let's talk music now. And an album released in 1961 by Sam Cooke. Can't wait for your book about Sam Cooke. But this is an interesting album, My Kind of Blues, because it's also a pretty good slice, long before every artist thought about doing this, of the Great American Songbook, doing songs by Gershwin, Rodgers and Hart, Irving Berlin, and more.
And he blues them up. And it's interesting because Sam Cooke, I don't know if people know this, but all of his albums, all of his studio albums, it's really quite singular, were concept albums of a sort. He always had something. One was like a tribute album to Billie Holiday. This one is the blues album. Another one is like the late night listening, cool out, I'm really down, meditating on the old unknown world type of album. So you didn't get that in rock and soul. Bing Crosby would do that. So he obviously wasn't rock or soul. And the American Songbook thing was more the province of an Ella Fitzgerald, like a jazz singer. It wasn't something that, and it was new when she did it. So you have Cooke doing that, which is odd maybe enough in itself, but then he's interpreting these songs in a very bluesy kind of way, because he was never an artist to just say, oh, okay, here's a hodgepodge for my long player, some B-sides, some singles. He didn't do that. The Beatles were that way too, and I think they were partially that way because they liked what Sam Cooke did, but he was, you don't think of Sam Cooke when I say like album-oriented artists. Who do we think about? Pink Floyd, Zeppelin. Like, they didn't have singles so much. I mean, Arnold Lane early on for Pink Floyd, but you don't think of like, ooh, that single by Led Zeppelin. And you think of singles for Sam Cooke. But I'd say even more so than the singles, he was an album-oriented artist, which was just massive at the time. No one did that.
And one of the bluesier songs, and everybody and their sister has recorded a version of it, but I love his version of Ivory Joe Hunter's Since I Met You, Baby.
Yes, and Sam Cooke was someone who could do marvelous things, I would say, with pronouns. Pronouns are very powerful, and the early Beatles realized this, and they would write pronouns, you and me and us and all of that, into their songs. But it's just, if you are having a conversation with somebody and you shift into like a we, and they might not even notice it. They probably don't even notice it consciously, but it's something that registers subconsciously. And Sam Cooke was always singing as a way to get over to you something that would connect the singer with the listener. There was always that euphonic bridge. And that's what, it's like that, I wrote about this in the book that I did too, that song by the Glaswegian band, Travis. They have a song called Writing to Reach You. And you wouldn't think there's maybe anything in common between this white Scottish band, Travis, and Sam Cooke, but it was very much with Cooke the idea of writing to reach you, singing to reach you. And he sang in such a way that his vocal style was a writing form unto itself. and you could hear him working out ideas in his own writing and the way he would sing. So it was a very almost like dialogic, conversational style. But here he's also using this classic American songbook, which is learned. It's not necessarily this kind of colloquial style, but he's making it into something that reaches out and reaches listeners.
From Sam Cooke to an album that didn't sell a whole lot of copies when it first came up, but it's been very influential through the years, and that is Nick Drake's Brighter Later. I always said back in the 80s, if you were a guy and you wanted a young woman to know that you were a sensitive guy, you would play Nick Drake's Pink Moon. But when you're all by yourself, you listen to Brighter Later, which was a more upbeat album.
Pink Moon might also sound like the kind of, you better keep an eye on me.
Well, yes, yeah. Don't leave me alone tonight. I can't be alone. I'm too fragile.
Yeah, it's Pink Moon is definitely a dark one. And I saw this thing on Twitter, such a cesspool of humanity, recently, where someone asked who were the best artists with 3 studio albums or less. And everyone said something incredibly stupid. The answers are Nick Drake, Joy Division, Stone Roses, artists like that. So this is number 2 for Nick Drake. And Pink Moon is the last one that's going to follow, is quite short. And it's just him with his guitar for the most part. And he had to record the guitar separately because he could not stop himself from shaking at that point. He was so far gone. But I would say this is kind of the Nick Drake album where he is most together in his personal life. So like if you were going to play one Nick Drake record for people, it would be this one. And it's interesting. If you look through the reviews, people didn't really know what to make of it. And there were a lot of left-handed compliments like, oh, you can't tell a difference between the songs, but the production value is elevated to something better than what it otherwise would be. He's a pretty pedestrian singer, but again, listen to how well the strings by the producer accentuate what he's trying to do. There really weren't any reviews at the time that were particularly favorable, and a lot of them did that whole kind of they sound alike, all of these songs. It's interesting to look back on some of these reviews, like Cream's Wheels of Fire was another one that got pasted, and the early Zeppelin albums all got pasted. And you can kind of understand, like with the Zeppelin, the overkill, the volume, all the multi-track guitars. But this wouldn't be the type of thing. Look, it sounds strange, but oftentimes, if you're a great artist for a while, you don't want it to stay this way. But it's a good thing when you're pasted. It shows that you are doing things that other people haven't done. And a lot of times, people will wait for other people to sound the kind of consensus note before they also just chip in, pile on, that kind of Junior Seau style of tackling, like, oh, I'll leap on the pile, half a tackle for me. That's how a lot of people live their lives, not as critical thinkers, but as opiners. So it's interesting to see the reviews for something like Brighter Later.
Yeah, and the fact that many years, long after Nick Drake's death, all of a sudden his music gained a whole new popularity, which to me is another indication that he was way ahead of his time and doing something that was so original that the average record buyer couldn't understand it.
I think they could, but the thing is, there's this, something happens where a lot of people say something, and then we get ourselves to see what we're able to see all along. People lack for confidence. It's like when the Beatles, before they became big in February 1964, we've talked about this, those records came out. Some of those records came out in the States, and they didn't do anything. Mm. It's the same people who loved the music in March and April of 64, heard it in December of 63, I Want to Hold Your Hand, She Loves You, and they didn't care. And it's not because they couldn't care. It's not because they faked it come the late winter and the spring. It was because a lot of people have the confidence to act on their own. And if you look at the lyrics, if you like, listeners, go out there later and just pull up the lyrics for some of these Nick Drake songs and Brighter Later. You read the lyrics, and it doesn't look like they'd be able to be sung. Like, the scansion will be off. He sings words in a way that I've never heard anyone else sing words. He makes these sort of strategic decisions for how long each word is going to last based upon the beat. And he'll have to stretch certain words and almost clip other words. But it's like this way of singing, this pure intuition. You could never teach, like, oh, I'm going to sing like Nick Drake. Here's how you should do it. So it's just a unique approach to vocals.
Well, if you haven't heard it, make a point of finding it and giving a listen to Brighter Later. Listen to Fly. That's my favorite song on the album. And, of course, if you haven't already, get out there and get a copy of Meathead Say the Realest Things. It's the latest from our friend Colin Fleming. Visit his website at colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. And, of course, tune in next Tuesday when Colin will be back right here. Thank you, my friend. We'll see you then.
Okay, sounds good.